Dear listener, before we start today's episode, I want to tell you about a resource I've created, which I want to share with you for free. I'll tell you what it is and how to get it. If you're not already writing tests for your Rails code, you're probably aware that testing can help you ship your work faster and with fewer defects. Because testing is such an in-demand skill, but since so few developers know how to do it properly, I've created a resource for you called The Beginner's Guide to Rails Testing. This guide is a short, downloadable book which answers the most common Rails testing questions that beginners tend to have, including, which testing framework should I use, RSpec or Minitest? What level of test coverage should I shoot for? What are the different kinds of Rails tests? What are all the Rails testing tools, and how do I use them? My guide covers these questions and several others. To get the Beginner's Guide to Rails Testing, go to railstestingguide.com. Now on to the episode. Hey, today I'm here with Vladimir Dementyev, developer at Evil Martians. Vlad, welcome to the show.
Hi, Jason. Hi, everyone. Thank you for having me today. Nice to meet you again.
Yeah, thanks for being here. And I had you on the show way back in episode 5. I just went back and looked, so it's been quite a while. For listeners who aren't familiar with you, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
So I'm working as a software engineer at Evil Martians. We're a consultancy agency doing product development, like any other kind of development, actually. So yeah, we're working worldwide with offices in US, Russia, and Japan. And I'm currently in Moscow. So
I looked, Vlad. And it's actually significantly colder here in Sand Lake, Michigan than it is in Moscow right now.
Maybe our heating service is a bit better. I don't know. If it's about, I actually forgot how to convert to Fahrenheit, so it doesn't matter.
What is it Celsius there right now?
It's about 5, I think, today. Uh-huh. Maybe a bit colder in the evening.
Okay. Yeah, I at least, of course, know that 0 is freezing in Celsius, so I can kind of imagine what. And, you know, when I did a little bit of traveling, I kind of got a feel for it. Like, when it's, like, 20 degrees Celsius outside, it, like, feels kind of nice. I don't remember how warm Fahrenheit that is. When it's 40 Celsius, it's, like, boiling outside.
I think 20 is about 70. It's like this.
That sounds right.
Okay. Maybe 68. Yeah.
But yeah, according to Google, right now it's 43 degrees Fahrenheit in Moscow and 29 in Sand Lake. We had some snow last night. Yeah. Wow. Anyway, so today we're going to be talking about the same topic that you're talking about at RailsConf. And by the time people listen to this, RailsConf will already have happened. So they can look forward to seeing the videos online, or they can reminisce about having watched it already for those of the listeners who also went to RailsConf. But can you tell us a little bit what the idea is for your RailsConf talk?
Sure. So my talk is called Frontendless Rails Frontend. Like, I don't know even how to correctly pronounce it. Like, it's a word, name I came up just, you know, for this conference. Mm-hmm. The idea is, the main kind of idea of this talk is to discuss how we can build modern web applications kind of without the necessity to use modern front-end tools like front-end frameworks and all that stuff. It's like, you know, reimagining full-stack Rails development in 2020s. And that's what I'm talking about how we came here and what tools do we have and how we can use them, like how I use them in my work and open source projects.
And maybe we can frame this a little bit. How do you view the whole JavaScript framework thing? Because we went through kind of the trajectory that has kind of happened with JavaScript online is like in the late 90s, early 2000s, there was barely any JavaScript, just a few sprinkles. You would use JavaScript to make something like a scroll along the bottom of the browser in the status bar. I don't know if you're old enough to remember those times, like back in the late 90s. But that was one of the like primary uses of JavaScript. And then, you know, there was like jQuery and Prototype in the mid 2000s, starting to make things a little more sophisticated when it comes to JavaScript, using JavaScript to make web applications have application-like behavior instead of just web pages. And then we had Ajax and everything, and that totally changed everything. And then maybe around 2010 or so is when we started to have these modern JavaScript frameworks like Angular and Backbone were kind of big earlier on, and then obviously React got bigger later on. And personally, I was kind of the opinion that a lot of applications were made into these single-page JavaScript-heavy applications that really shouldn't have been, because it added a lot of development complexity and overhead when it could have just been a regular old Rails CRUD application, because it's not doing anything all that crazy. What's your take on that whole thing?
So I can say anything about 90s. So I got my first computer only 15 years ago. So I just have no experience with that. But yeah, as you said, this kind of evolution of web frameworks, like both backend and frontend, led us to a situation when Rails and other Ruby frameworks, not only Ruby frameworks, became mostly API providers. Due to the popularity and growth of front-end ecosystem, which were kind of sleeping for ages, and in 2010 or so something, it awoke and started to evolve. And the thing is that I think at that moment, it wasn't like a wrong decision to bet on front-end technologies, because our like Rails stack was a bit lagging behind in many ways. So this JavaScript evolution, for example, led to the package management appearance like NPM and later Yarn. And do remember we were using Bundler to, you know, install assets through gems, or even using just putting minimized JavaScript into vendor assets folder.
Can we talk about that for a second? Public.
Yeah, sure.
I feel like people don't talk about this very much, but the whole like JavaScript in a gem idea, I think, is just so like nuts, and like we need to stop doing that. And because like, think about it, like why do we put JavaScript into a gem and bring it into the project that way? One reason I think is because until we got Webpacker, we didn't have a way to include JavaScript dependencies in our projects that was as nice as Bundler. Now you can just do yarn add package name and it's in there. And so that was kind of like a bastardized way to get those JavaScript libraries into your project. And then kind of the other reason is that sometimes these JavaScript in a gem packages handle a little bit of the configuration for you. And that's kind of nice. But I think there's something really inappropriate about installing a Ruby gem just to get some JavaScript code.
Yeah, I agree with you as of today, because I don't know, like, I don't understand why do we need a Tailwind Rails gem, to be honest. But as of like 10 years ago, Bundler was the best way to have a consistent dependencies in the project. And putting gems into Bundler was a hack, but that was like a smart hack. we were, you know, in control of our dependencies, and we had a log file, like, right? That's good. And the whole idea behind this and all the asset pipeline and sprockets or related stuff was actually very cool back in the days, but like it's still almost the same as it were 10 years ago. And that's why today I think it's kind of outdated. So yeah, front-end ecosystem solved this problem, and well, in a similar way, but you know, it's now has a package management systems and they work, and they just like, you know, I don't know. There, I can see any reason to not use this ecosystem if you use JavaScript or CSS or whatever. So like now it's not a good way to manage asset dependencies, I think. But 10 years ago, it was pretty much okay. It's much better to use gems than just putting scripts into the vendor assets or loading them from whatever, wherever they are. So like that was a necessary evil, kind of.
Yeah. Yeah. I pretty much agree with everything you just said. It was probably a good way to do it back then. It's no longer a great way because we have better alternatives now, like using Webpacker. Your talk mentions view component, stimulus reflex, and Hotwire. And I'm curious how those things fit into like your vision of like how you want to do your front end coding in the future. How do those three tools come into the picture?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. So let's talk first about, I think, stimulus reflex and Hotwire. And then about view components, because like view component is a consequence of using other tools, as I see it. So what do we need to build a modern web application today? We need it to be fast. We need it to be good, cool from the UI perspective. I know that it's like beautiful CSS, not Bootstrap. And we want it to be interactive and reactive. And the term reactivity is like, I don't know a good definition. So I define it as an ability of the application to instantly react to the events happening like locally, I mean, in the browser. So user interactions, and also outside of the browser, like in the system as a whole. And the simplest example could be like chat, right? Or any other real-time updates. That's kind of reactivity. We don't need to hit reload to see the changes. Everything changes like at the same time the change appears on the server. And if we decide not to use front-end frameworks and keep the state in the browser, so what is the biggest difference, I think, between HTML-first approach, HTML over the wire? That's what we do if we choose classic Rails approach. And the SPA approach is that single page applications manage states on the front end. So, and that helps them to be reactive, to use optimistic updates and all that stuff. It's like, but when server in response of everything, we need a way to kind of send or push data, push changes from server to clients without request. And that's where such things as HTML over WebSocket come into place. But let's like remember this. Let's start first with the first part of the Hotwire. What is Hotwire? It's actually multiple tools. First one is Turbo, which is like a new version of Turbolinks. And the second one is Stimulus. So Turbo or Turbo Drive, previously known as Turbolinks, is like an easiest way to transform your HTML application into a single page application. It helps to build a more, I don't know, like faster interactive UI from the like perceived view. And it's just a little piece of magic that works. I don't know whether we want to talk about like details, how exactly it helps us to like load pages faster or whatever. I think most of the listeners at least heard about Turbolinks. And then we have Turbo Frames, which is a new thing, which is like the same idea applied not to the whole page, but to a part of the page, which allows you to do very like interactive stuff, which you had used, which you, you know, had to build with JavaScript before, without any JavaScript at all, with just HTML and Rails controllers. Let me try to describe an example of Turbo Frame usage, which I found very like elegant solution to a problem. You know, when front-end frameworks are compared, the first thing we do, we build a to-do list application, right? Like a list, we can add items, we can mark them as completed, we can delete them. So with Turbo and Turbo Frames, we can build this application with zero JavaScript, with just HTML. And the idea here, like I implemented it, we can just wrap any item into a Turbo Frame, like isolated part of the page, which could be updated independently in response to actions like clicks or form submissions. And if we wrap every item into Turbo Frame, we can like implement deletion or completion as a form submission and respond with a new HTML partial, not the whole page, but just a single partial representing this item, and it's going to be replaced. And
let me see if I understand this idea, because I haven't used Potwire, any of the stuff at all yet. The way that I might traditionally do something like this is like, okay, let's say I have a form that I want to submit asynchronously. And so I'll have like a div on the page that contains that form. And like, maybe let me get even more specific and I'll go with your to-do app example. And let's say there's a to-do item text input, and then below that there's a list of to-do items. And so I might keep the list of to-do items in some sort of element, and then when I click the add button that's associated with that to-do item text input, I want a to-do item to show up in that list without the page actually reloading. The way that I would do that before is I would have some JavaScript event associated with the form submission, and then once I get that response back, I would refresh that div. But it sounds to me like with Turbo Frames, kind of that same thing. It's maybe even that exact same thing, but just not achieved in exactly the same way, but same exact concept. Is that right?
Yeah, totally. So technically, it's the same thing. Like HTML request is intercepted, and it's just handled by Turbo library, JavaScript library, and it replaces the div with the new HTML. It's very similar to what we did with JavaScript templates back in the days. Like you destroy ARB.js, where you might like click something, jQuery, find and remove. But you don't need to write this JavaScript. You only use your partials. That's not exactly true. You probably want to add additional partials for that, but that's like a trade-off. Like I don't know. I'm not sure this is a weak part of the Turbo Frame, the problem of it. But yeah, you might need to add custom partials for all the possible states. But in this particular example, we don't need to do anything. You just organize your HTML in partials, which you can reuse for like in-place updates.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. And when I'm using Hotwire, to what extent, like, am I conscious of using these individual things? Like when you use Turbo Links, or I guess it's now called Turbo Drive, it's just kind of there, and you're not really using it, it might affect some of the parts of your application. Like, for example, if you have an action that needs to be triggered when a page loads, you wouldn't have like a JavaScript on load event. You would have like a JavaScript on turbo links, whatever it is, event. So like those small things are changed, but like you're not really doing any meaningful amount of coding related to turbo links or turbo drive. It's just there. What about with turbo frames? Is there like turbo frame specific code, or what I think of it as like Hotwire specific code? How does all that stuff go?
So turbo frame is just a part of turbo. Like it's already included, but it's only activated if you have a turbo frame tags on your page. So Hotwire use custom elements to kind of activate features. So one such feature is turbo frame. And when you add this specific tag, it activates JavaScript from the library, which does all the work. And a nice example is turbo stream. But I think let's leave it for a bit later, I think, because it's about like more about reactivity, I think. But it could be used as turbo frame as well. But like we are going too deep into the details, I think, here.
Okay. So there's, go ahead. Yeah,
So like turbo drive and turbo frames are like turbo links, 6 or 7, whatever it should be. So it's like a new version of turbo links. It's the same library and same code base. You can use both of them. You can use just one of them, like, but that's a single library. It's like a turbo library.
Okay. And then I don't know if it makes sense to bring view component into the picture in this part of the sequence, or if there's other stuff that makes sense to touch on first. Is now a good time to bring in the view component stuff?
I think, well, we can, but let's maybe discuss stimulus reflex and turbo streams actually. So, because where I'm leading us, the thing is using this turbo stimulus reflex, whatever stuff, we keep everything in HTML templates kind of. So our page representation is built from HTML templates, and we're going to have a lot of them because we might need some partials for particular cases. We want to like split our page into components actually, even before view components, because we want to render parts of them. And that's the same for turbo and stimulus reflex actually. I don't know whether we want to discuss stimulus, like regular stimulus, JavaScript library. It's like, in my opinion, it's just it provides a glue and minimal JavaScript to add some interactivity which couldn't be achieved by sending stuff from server, or which doesn't require server at all. So we don't need to hit server every time we want to build something interactive. Okay, let's move to view components. So as I said, so even for the to-do list example, we need to split everything into partials. And imagine if we want to build the whole application using this philosophy. And I think we will end up with dozens, or not really dozens, but hundreds of template files. And as Joel Huxley said in one of the recent episodes about view component, managing a lot of templates is like hard because it's not a regular Ruby code, which could be linted, analyzed statically, whatever. It's a bit harder to analyze templates. And reusing pieces of logic within this template, because they are not just pure HTML, right? We might have conditionals, loops, even Ruby code in templates. And all that makes maintaining this HTML, you know, heap, whatever, much harder than dealing with Ruby code, which could be organized. So we need a way to organize our UI elements. And that's where view components come into a stage. And by view components, I'm not referring to a particular library, actually. I'm referring to a pattern, probably we might call it a pattern. So an idea of building UI from individual, reusable, isolated blocks. And this idea is not new. And actually, this idea, well, became popular and evolved in the front-end world, and more precisely, React library taught us to think in components. And now we like bring this knowledge to Ruby with all those Ruby libraries, including view component library.
Okay. Yeah, and I'll have to go back and listen to my own episode because, like, even though it's pretty recently that was recorded, I don't even remember. I remember in the episode that I had kind of an aha experience where I was listening to Joel explain all this stuff, and I was like, oh, yeah, okay. I didn't really get it before, but now I get it. And now I don't get it again because I forgot what me and Joel talked about. So I'll have to go back and listen to that one. But, yeah, dear listener, if you're not too familiar with view components either, it was... Well, at this point, it'll be several episodes ago, but hang on a second. I can check real quick. When was the Joel episode? It was episode number... It's taking me so long to find it. Episode number 88 was the view component episode. And Vlad, do you think you could help us understand, like, I don't know, why would you use view components? And, like, is it for everybody or only for, like, large projects or what?
Okay, so my personal experience with view components could help me to, like, define the advantages I see. For example, I like testability. So we can test view components in isolation, unit testing pretty fast. And it's actually pretty helpful. And yeah, I've never tested views, maybe twice in my life. But with view components, when you really build a component, something logically isolated, but having some logical branching, it really helps to, I don't know, to design a component probably, because it, like with every other piece of code. So what is view component? It's actually a Ruby class and a template, right? Like in a very simple form. And this Ruby class could be tested and this with the template, along with the template. And testing this isolated components could help you to define a better design, like in TDD. So you write a test, you figure out, oh, I have too many like states, switches, arguments, whatever. That's one of the way like benefits. And it also helps you to avoid testing all the logical edge cases, for example, in your system test. I'm writing system tests, trying to write them as much as possible, as much as like, but not too much because they're slow, even if you do all the tricks. And again, I'm kind of repeating what Joel said, but with view components, with testing components in isolation, you don't need to test all the states on your in your system tests. And that helps to like to build a more reliable software thing, because usually we don't care about tests. And like right today, I was working on a feature which was really rearranging items on the page. Like this page hasn't been migrated to view components. It's just a long partial with a dozen of partials used inside it. Like I don't even know all the things we're touching here. And I don't really know how to write a test. like writing a system test for this feature would require to spend twice or thrice more time to write the feature itself. And that's a rare case where I started with the feature, not with the test. And I'm not sure I'm going to write a test. Maybe just a QA specialist going to test it and that's it. But with view components, I could write a test and I pretty quickly verify that it works as I expected and go further without investing
and
a lot of
my time. Is the reason for that particular case because there's so many dependencies involved, you would have to create this scenario in the system test, and that's where the time consumingness comes from, whereas if you were to write just a view component test, then all those dependencies wouldn't be a necessary part of the picture?
Yeah. So this particular page requires a lot of setup, and to be honest, I'm kind of not 100% familiar with the whole code base and the whole logic of this pretty big application. So for me, it will take a bit of time. We don't have any system test for this page. So if we had one, I adopted it and that could be good. But we don't know. We don't have any. And with view components, I could just extract this particular page part into a component, which really accepts only one argument, and depending on the like user feature tag or whatever, it renders different UI, and I could be able to test it. I could be able to test what it renders, whether it like invokes database somewhere in the middle in prevent this, for example. I prefer views not to hit database wherever whenever possible. So there are a lot of tests. Like testing is not only for correctness, right? It's like a companion tool for refactoring, development, analysis, and whatever. And with view components, we can test our views and have all this stuff included. And that's just the first, I think, benefit of using components that comes into my mind.
Okay.
Another reason, I think that should be the first reason, actually, is that when you start thinking in components, when you start thinking about organizing your view elements into something independent, isolated, again, like with splitting, I don't know, fat models into logically independent parts, here you can find problems with your design and solve it or prevent such problems. So you can have isolated Ruby code, isolated templates, CSS, JavaScript, whatever you use with component. And actually one thing, which is a minor thing, but it's really powerful. Again, I'm recalling Joel's episode, is that view component is rendered in a separate context as regular templates. You don't have this problem of leaking instance variables, for example, from your controller. And for the classic Rails apps started 10 years ago, something like the one I'm working on, that's really a problem because sometimes a partial requires some instance variable. You don't know why and where
don't know where it came from.
Yeah. So with view components, you don't have such problem. That's like just by design. And that's cool. That leads to better architecture in the end.
Yeah, that does seem nice because it always makes me a little bit uneasy when I have like a controller that has an associated template. That connection's pretty easy to make. You have your instance variables in the template. You can look at the controller. You see the instance variables there. But then if it's a template that has one or more partials associated with it, and you go into the partials and you see instance variables there, that's when it can become a little less clear. And especially when there's like partials that include other partials, it becomes a little crazy. And it's like, everybody knows that it's not good to have global variables. And the reason that it's not good to have global variables is because you just don't know what is touching that global variable. And so you can't be too certain what's happening to it. And you can't really follow the execution path and be sure that your conception of the execution path is correct. And so people are kind of familiar with that concept in Ruby code, but then in views, it's kind of thrown out the window and we have these global values everywhere. And so if we can have something that makes it physically impossible for those global values to be used, then that seems good. Yeah. Okay. A couple unrelated off-topic questions before we go. Have you been speaking at a lot of these remote conferences since coronavirus has started and we haven't been able to do in-person conferences?
So I think I spoke at 5 conferences so far. So 1 year passed, and the first one was RailsConf 2020. And the last one was RailsConf 2021. But I had an opportunity to speak the offline event a month ago in Russia. This was a Ruby meetup in St. Petersburg, the first after the lockdown stuff. And we are going to have a conference this June in St. Petersburg as well. So yeah, so like in Russia, we starting to meet in person. Like, that's really cool.
Yeah, it's great.
So like that's well, I don't really like online conferences.
Yeah, same here. Yes. I'm sorry to say, I haven't participated in a single online conference, and I don't plan to. I'm just waiting until we can have in-person conferences again.
Yeah. Then to be honest, I only submitted talks which I already had prepared, so I haven't written or whatever any new talks so far. And my RailsConf talk is just an updated version of my last year Ruby Russia talk. And that was a different big experience. Like, that was the only online conference which felt like almost offline, because we haven't recorded talks ourselves. We just met in the studio, and that was like giving a talk, but like a few people. But that's very different than recording at home or recording online or presenting online, which I don't like. But having even a couple of, you know, human eyes watching at you makes a difference. So, yeah.
Yeah. Do you think you're going to come to RailsConf 2022 if it's an in-person conference?
Well, that's another problem. Like, if I get a visa,
oh, I see.
Because I got kind of stuck in Russia. I actually came to Russia to extend my visa, but I'm still here and I'm not gonna leave this country in the nearest future. So yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's crazy. When I spoke at RubyConf India in 2019, I got notified, like, it was only like 2 weeks before the conference happened. Like, it was very little notice. And so I had to get all the, what is it? Was it a visa? Yeah, I guess a visa is what you have to get. And it was like right down to the wire for me getting all that stuff straightened out before I went, and all the vaccinations and stuff like that you have to get. I remember when I went to Nigeria in 2015, I was going there for work and I had to get all my stuff in order. I didn't have a passport because I had never left the United States before. And so I had to get a passport specifically for this. And it was another short notice kind of thing. And so I had to do everything like expedited, and it was all a rush. And it was the day I was supposed to leave for Nigeria, and I still didn't have my passport. And my passport came in the mail that same day before I got on the plane. I would have been like in such big trouble if it didn't work out. So I'm really glad that did. But yeah, traveling internationally can be tough sometimes.
Yeah, you know, but I think, you know, receiving documents by mail is the thing that amazes me in the United States. Like, wow.
Wait, how does that work? Like, if you get your passport, it just comes in the mail. How does it work in Russia?
I come to the office, so like wants to take a picture of me and like sign some documents, and in a 10 days or something, I come there again and get my passport. So
that makes a lot more sense. It seems crazy to me that they just put this incredibly valuable thing in the mail. It doesn't seem like a high theft risk because, like, nobody can really do all that much with your passport unless they're, like, really sophisticated and really are serious about doing something. But the chances of that are pretty slim. But it's like you kind of don't want your passport just sitting in your mailbox. Anything could happen. Anyway, a totally different question. Russia's on my list of places to visit sometime. If I go to Moscow, first of all, if I go to Moscow, I'm going to come knocking on your door and we'll hang out. But also, if somebody goes to Moscow, what's like a couple of places that everybody who goes to Moscow should visit?
Well, my personal top two would be, like, you know, I don't know whether it's okay to translate it, but sometimes they call Sparrow Hills or Vorobyovy Gory. That's a place where Moscow State University main building is located. It's probably one of the most familiar buildings in Moscow. There is a viewing point, cable car across the river, and just a beautiful place, green place in Moscow where you can see all the like main, I don't know how they're called.
Soviet like buildings. Or whatever.
Yeah. So I think that's my favorite place in Moscow, probably because I was studying in this university and lived there. Well, what else? I don't know. Like just the city center, everything close to the Kremlin, but not too close. It's pretty beautiful place to see, to just to walk around all the boulevards.
You can actually
streets.
Go on like a Kremlin tour, right?
Yeah, you can, but I don't know. There are some, like, just a tour, like Kremlin, I don't know, churches, like large bells, like a bit larger than Liberty Bell. I don't know. I've been there like maybe 15 years ago last time.
Okay.
So there are a lot of places in Moscow actually to visit, and maybe taking a boat ride, which I think, yeah, that's going to be my number two, taking a boat ride and see everything from the river.
Okay. What's the river that goes through Moscow?
Moscow River.
Oh, okay.
Simple, yeah.
Got it. Okay, well, great. Those things are on my bucket list now. Very last question. Where should people go to find out more about you online?
So my GitHub, my username is Pelkan, and I'm sometimes writing like announcements, some short tips on Twitter, where I am could be found as Pelkan_Tula. Tula, that's my like a hometown. It's 100 miles from Moscow.
I always wondered what that was. What's the Pelkan part?
Whoa, that's like a long story. So there's actually a typo in this word. The second letter should be O, Polkan. And Polkan is like typical Russian nickname for dogs.
Got it.
And, you know, that was the only nickname I had back in my childhood. And when I needed to choose a username in the internet era, I didn't have any other idea just to use it, but I made a typo and now I'm Pelkan and that's it.
I see. Now I know the story behind that. And by the way, I just want to say that I've always found your posts on the Evil Martians blog to be really good. A lot of times I'll just be like searching for something and the post that comes up is an Evil Martians post. Like, the Ruby on Whales thing. I think I came across that when it was being shared on Reddit. But that was super great. I got a lot of value out of that when I was trying to figure out Docker, which is super difficult for me to figure out. But that post helped out a lot. And just in general, your Evil Martians posts are great. So thanks for putting those out there.
Thank you. And actually, at the time of this episode comes out, they're going to be a post on Hotwire, So some things I talked about today, but more details. I haven't written it yet, actually, but it should have been, it should be reading to the time of the RailsConf and released. So yeah, okay. If you want to,
yeah, if you give me that link, I'll put it in the show notes for this episode.
Yeah, yeah, I actually have a link already. I even have a cover image for this post because I put a link on my slides for RailsConf, which has been already recorded. Yeah, so like, you know, that's conference-driven writing.
Right.
So I'm just promising to release something because it's already announced in the upcoming talk. Well, that's interesting.
Experience. Yeah, I do that a lot too. Like if I'm going to give a talk on something, might as well just make a blog post out of it too, because I already have to learn all this stuff and all that stuff. Okay, well, of course, put all that stuff in the show notes. And Vlad, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Jason. See you again, maybe in Russia.
Hopefully. All right, talk to you later.
Thank you. Bye.